And if you're the parent of young children, these are wonderful stories to read to your children at home, because they're just thrilled to hear about them and to see how they turn out. And not only that, it's a great lesson of faith and will help them develop their faith and make choices like these men made. We want to notice that in the beginning, Daniel and, of course, his friends that we're going to be looking at were all handsome, young, and very gifted. And so the first lesson we can all learn is that sometimes God blesses young people with these kind of gifts, and with those blessings you can either use them to the glory of God or use them for your selfish purposes. Obviously, Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego all chose to serve God, so even though they were very intelligent young men, very handsome young men, very gifted young men, there's something more to them than just what the eye sees, and that is their great heart of faith and belief. And so the first lesson I would suggest to you is that beautiful people can do beautiful things. But if you're beautiful on the outside, be sure that you always develop that inner beauty, because the inner beauty will last much longer than the outer beauty. And so don't spend all of your time on the outside. It's also interesting when we look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and as they have to disagree with the king, and in chapter 3, refuse the king's order to fall down and to worship his golden image, that we might get the misunderstanding that, well, these men were rebels, and we all need to be rebels, so let's just all revolt against the government, because after all, didn't these men do that? And so as you read chapter 1, you don't get that impression. What you realize is that these young men, as much as was possible, lived peaceably with all men. So they adapted to the foreign names that they were given. They adapted to the foreign language. They adapted to the customs as much as was possible. They weren't rebels at all. They were prisoners, they were slaves in a foreign country, but they tried to get along to the best of their ability, and thus we could not classify these men as slaves who are just going around trying to cause trouble. That's not the picture at all. And it's also a lesson to all of us. Imagine being transported from America, let's say to China or to Russia or to some foreign country. Would you be able to adapt? Would you be able to get along with those who oversaw your well-being then? You've lost your freedom. Could you change and adapt to the best of your ability, or are you stuck in a rut? And sometimes I hear people say, well, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, I always say we're not old dogs, so we can learn if we choose to. And in verse 8, notice again the language. It says, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Now, why is that? Well, we would say in modern language that obviously the Persian or the Babylonian food was not kosher. It didn't meet up to the strict dietary restrictions of the Jewish people. Well, how did Daniel know that? Because he grew up, obviously, with parents who cared about God's law and instructed him in that law. And then when he was transported out of his homeland to a foreign place and he was in difficult circumstances, he had the courage and the character and the conviction to say, I'm still going to do what's right to the best of my ability, and so I purpose in my heart not to do these things. It would have been easy for him to say, well, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I guess in Babylon, do as the Babylonians do. Or he could say, well, I can't help it because I'm being forced against my will to do these things. But none of that said. He simply said that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not what? Defile himself. Young people, I'd advise you to have that same purpose in your heart. Today we live under the gospel age, but there's a nice and a worthwhile moral precept for your life. And determine in your heart not to defile yourself with the world's delicacies and wines. If you make that choice, you'll be as blessed as Daniel was in his lifetime. Also, the word wine is the Hebrew word yayin, which means wine is fermented by implication, intoxication. And this was the typical banqueting wine, or that of the wine bibber, according to Strong's Hebrews Concordance. So that's why Daniel didn't want to participate in these things, because he'd been taught better. And there's no one telling him to do these things or not to, but he purposed in his heart that he would not do these things. And so we see that, don't we? He's strong-willed. He respects the law of the Lord. He's not a convenient believer who just does what he can do when it's easy to do it. This man has convictions, and when he's a prisoner in a foreign land with no outside support, he says, I am going to dedicate my heart to God and do the right thing. I don't care what the world around me thinks is right. I'm going to do what God tells me is right. And so he's not a convenient believer. He's not an everyday, a Sunday morning only follower, so to speak. And he has a strong will in the right direction. A lot of times parents tell me, well, my child's strong-willed. I said, that's always good as long as you get that will pointed in the right direction. When you get strong will pointed in the wrong direction, that's a bad thing. But Daniel made the right choice. And so we need to understand that. He respected the Bible. In verse 9, notice also the test. God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. So there's a lesson there, obviously. God knows the heart and the character of Daniel, and as a result, God does for Daniel what Daniel can't do for himself. But in spite of that, it says in verse 10, the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So this gentleman is saying, the king's food is best for you, and if you'll eat the portion that he gives you, you'll be young and strong and handsome and good looking, and if I don't train you up like that, then my head's on the chopping block, and now what am I going to do? It wasn't that he was against Daniel, but Daniel said, all right, let's just have a test. Let us eat the vegetables and drink water for 10 days, and at the end of 10 days, if we look worse than the other men who are drinking the king's wine and eating the king's delicacies, then you do as you please. Did Daniel know how that was going to turn out? Well, I don't suppose he did, but the results were at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better, watch this, and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Was that a miracle, or was that the diet that God knows better than we do? Who knows? But we do know that he did what God required him as a young Jewish man under the law of Moses to do, and as a result, he was blessed for it. That's walking by faith, ladies and gentlemen, and you and I can follow that lesson too. So what's the lesson we learn from this example? God's blessings always follow our obedience. Verse 17, as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. They couldn't do that for themselves. God gave it to them. Now remember, they were born handsome men. They were born intelligent men. They were born under the Jewish law. But in addition to that, God blessed them because of the decisions they made and the conscience that they displayed. And it wasn't following the world. It wasn't following the path of least resistance. It was doing the right thing regardless. And when you teach young people to do the right thing regardless, then you've got something worth having. And when we as adults and Christians remember, I'm going to do the right thing regardless, then we don't have to make as many decisions as those people who wake up every morning and have to decide if they're going to do the right thing or the wrong thing today or not. Well, let's look at some other examples of how God blesses us if we obey Him. In the matter of giving, which is a great stumbling block for a lot of people and not a few Christians, 2 Corinthians chapter 9 talks about the contribution of the brethren for the needy saints. And after they had been encouraged to give like the Macedonians had, and hopefully had followed up as they did, it says in verse 8, God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. As it is written, He is dispersed abroad. He is given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. Now may he who supplies seed for the sower and bread for food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness. Now what is that saying to these people who are giving to those who need? You do the right thing and God will bless you. That doesn't mean if I give $100 to the needy saints in Jerusalem that God's going to give me $200 back next week. But it does mean if I put God first in my life and God first in my billfold and I do the right thing, God will take care of me the way God sees fit. And that might be material blessings because God's going to bless the man who's going to use his money for the right purpose. And if a man is stingy with $10, God's not going to give him $100. If Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego don't do the right thing, we don't have the book of Daniel. We don't have the story we're looking at today. And so here's one young man, Daniel, who purposes in his heart not to defile himself, and he affects millions of people ever since. You and I can determine that we're going to use our money to the glory of God, and God will bless us just as much as we need. He'll give me all the money my character can handle, and he'll give me all the money that I need to bless others with it. And that's the very point of 2 Corinthians chapter 9. And it's not the health and wealth doctrine, it's the putting God first doctrine, God will bless you when you do doctrine. And we need to keep that in mind. So it's not just Daniel and these men. How about Cornelius in Acts chapter 10? Cornelius was a Roman soldier. He was head over 100 men. And yet in that environment, you might say, well, you know, soldiers, they can't do anything but be rough and tough and coarse and crude, and they rule the world with an iron fist, and they go by the principle might makes right. So what do we expect out of Cornelius? Well, it says in verse 2, he's a devout man and one who feared God with all his household. Would you say, ladies and gentlemen, that describes all Roman centurions of that day and age? No. Because if it did, all that the inspired letter would have to say is, Cornelius, a centurion, and we'd know that. Oh, he's one of those good fellas. Well, where did Cornelius learn that? Did he learn it from his fellow soldiers? No. Did he learn it from his mom and dad? Probably not. He learned it from the Jewish nation where he had been posted nearby. And it said he was a devout man and one who feared God with all of his household. So why did Cornelius do what he did? Because he wanted to. And notice again, like the previous passage, it says he gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always. Is Cornelius trying to do the right thing? Yes. Is he going against the grain of the Roman soldiers? Yes. Is he probably gaining the favor of his superior officers? Probably not. So why is he doing this? Because he is a man who's decided, I'm going to do the right thing regardless. Does God see and bless him? Verse 4. When he observed him, he was afraid. Excuse me, verse 3. About the ninth hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God coming in and saying to him, Cornelius. And when he observed him, he was afraid and said, what is it, Lord? So he said to him, your prayers and your alms have come up as a memorial before God. God heard Cornelius' prayer. God saw Cornelius' life. God gave Cornelius the opportunity that man's life warranted, and that was an opportunity to be saved. And while we're at it as a side note, sometimes we wonder, well, what about that fella that's in some foreign country way off the middle of nowhere and the gospel's not there? Is he saved without the gospel? Cornelius is a fella who is a Gentile. He's a Roman soldier. But he has a desire in his heart to please God, and he's doing the best that he knows, and God sends a messenger to him to be sure he gets the opportunity to be saved. And that's all we need to worry about. Our job is to go preach the gospel to every creature. Go make disciples of all nations. Because God sees the hearts of every human being on his earth. And if he sees a man like Cornelius, wherever he may be, rest assured that God in his providence will provide a way. You and I just need to be the tools that his providence can use when the time comes. But again, God's blessings follow Cornelius' obedience. How about the parable of the talents in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 41? Do we see the same principle there? It says, I will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me. These people did not obey God, and as a result, God's cursings followed them. So, we receive according to what we deserve. But then go back to Daniel chapter 1 and notice the next point, and that is this. It says, at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Would you say, looking over the life of young Daniel, that that early decision paid off? Shake or nod, wink or blink. Sure it did. So somebody says, man, I want to be the king's right-hand man. I want to be in the White House advising the next president of the United States. Well, you might have that opportunity if you're intelligent, if you're good-looking, and if you're dedicated to God like Daniel was. But if not, then you do the best you can wherever you are and in whatever circumstance. And if you do, then the question is, what will God give you? Well, in the parable of the talents, the fellow who did what God said was blessed more. And the fellow who buried his talent in the ground was blessed less. So if you don't take your God-given talents and use them to the glory of God, don't expect more to come. So we learned that from Daniel. Now skip over, if you would, to Daniel chapter 3, and let's continue the rest of the story. In verse 1, it says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura at the province of Babylon. And then in verses 2 and 3, he repeats the names of all these different government officials that I'm not going to name. But he basically says in verse 4, a herald cries aloud and says, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Yay! Fun and joy. Unless you're a Jew. Unless you're a monotheistic Jew. Unless you're a Jew who's been taught under the Ten Commandments, which says, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. You shall not make any graven images of gold or silver, like unto man or any other creature. And now as a Jew, a God-fearing man like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego were, I'm sure if I were there in their shoes, when I heard that proclamation, a cold sweat would have broken out of my brow. How about you? And so the question for us now is this, what would you do? What would you do? Suppose President Obama makes such a declaration. We proclaim that after the blowing of all the horns and trumpets and every other band we can find in the United States of America, that we should all bow down and worship the golden image of President Obama, and nobody can worship Jesus Christ anymore. So when you hear the horn blowing, you bow down, and if you don't, we find out about it, we're going to throw you into a burning fiery furnace. Would you say, well, you know, one sin's not all that bad. Or would you say, it doesn't count if I cross my fingers? Or would you say, well, I'm going to bow down, but God knows my heart, and He knows I'm not really bowing down on the inside. You know, that's not far-fetched, is it? That's kind of some of the excuses I've heard people make. Well, let's not feel too sorry for Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, because I remember the New Testament, there was a young prophet by the name of John the Baptist, and he had the courage of his convictions to tell Herod that he and his wife didn't have the right to be married. And he was thrown in prison and lost his head because of it. Did he do the wrong thing? How about Stephen, who in Acts 7 preached such a scathing sermon condemning his Jewish brethren that they decided the best reaction to that sermon was to stone him to death? Stephen, you should have preached a different sermon. No, Stephen was inspired by God. But it's a good question for you and me to ask ourselves, what would I do in those circumstances? We'd all like to say, well, of course we'd do what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. We would obey God, and we would not bow down to that idol because we're not supposed to be idolaters. And if we get thrown in the fire, then so what? But brethren, as I've always said, it's really easy to say that, but when the time comes to find out if you have the courage to do it, that's another question. And sometimes our convictions are there, but our courage fails us. Do you remember the apostles? I will not deny you. Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. Jesus said, yes, you will, three times. And so we'd all like to say, I'd do exactly what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would, but we have to ask ourselves, would we? Well, as we read in verses 8 through 12, the Babylonians obviously see what's going on, and they tattle on these men. At that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, if you want to get somebody in trouble with the king, be sure that you entwine the king's ego with your request. Notice he says, they do not give due regard to you. They do not serve your gods. They do not serve your image. So who's being disrespected? They're saying, you, great King Nebuchadnezzar, are being disrespected by these three Jewish men. And that's how you get people in trouble. Why were they doing that? Who appointed them to go tattle to the king? But Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 13, was in a rage and fury. And there's a great lesson there, and that is, don't get kings who have absolute authority in a rage and fury. But they weren't trying to. Remember, they tried to get along. That's why they're going by the name Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But in his fury, he gives them a test and at least has the presence of mind and says to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? As angry as he was, he at least had the presence of mind to ask these men, is what I've heard about you true? And brethren, there's a good lesson too. Do you believe everything you hear about somebody else? If you do, come back to tonight's lesson and hear a lesson about gossip. We'll talk about that then. Because a lot of things are said aren't exactly right. And you can repeat almost word for word a quote of an individual and just change one or two words and it turns the entire thing around. I'll give you an example. You remember the Garden of Eden? When Satan asked Eve, may you eat of every tree in the garden? She said, we may eat of every tree except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. From the day that we eat of it, we shall surely die. Satan just changed one word. You shall not surely die. You see how easy it is to twist people's words? So Nebuchadnezzar is a wise king in the sense that he says, is it true that you don't worship this golden image that I have set up? So in verse 15, he gives them a second chance. I appreciate that. Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Would you like to be in those men's shoes? Who is the God that will deliver you? You got to remember, this is Nebuchadnezzar, who's already learned a little bit in chapter 2 about Daniel and his ability to interpret dreams. But now the test is on, and now they have their opportunity. And I want you to notice the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer to you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll never find a greater example of courage under the worst circumstances than this statement here. And it's not rebellion. They're trying to get along, but the king has crossed the line and required them to obey man rather than God, and they said, we can't do that. We have to obey God rather than man. And Jesus taught us in the New Testament, don't fear those who can destroy the body, and after that have no more that they can do, but rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him. And when Peter wrote 1 Peter under adverse circumstances, and the Christians of his day were going under a fiery trial, one of the instructions he gave them was, you stand up under the temptation and don't show them that you're afraid. Easy to do when your life's not on the line, but can you show courage in the face of death? Because I don't think the Bible says that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are wearing fireproof garments. That they've got all this modern material and they don't have to worry about the fire. And yet they do the right thing regardless. And that's the principle that we learned earlier. They have courage. They have deep conviction. They are determined to do the right thing, and that spells character. And ladies and gentlemen, that's how you spell success. The lesson? Do you have what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had? And the question is, if you say yes, how do you know? And if you say no, how do you know? And if you say I'm not sure, how do you know? And the answer is in the text. How did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego know they could do this at that time? And I'll show you the answer. And here's the key. Before you and I can pass the big test, we've got to learn to pass all the little bitty tests. And you and I as Christians are being challenged in our faith every single day. You'll have circumstances where you make little decisions about little things, but that tells the story. If you begin to compromise your values and your morals and you think, well, I can't help it, well, that's the way it is, things are different, la-da-da, la-da-dee, la-da-dum, then all of a sudden it doesn't take long for the devil. He just keeps whittling away until you don't have any character at all. And so what are the little tests that these men had passed? Well, we saw them already. They refused to eat the king's portions. Or at least Daniel did, and I would suspect these men did as well. They certainly refused to bow down when nobody they thought was looking. And so they passed the little test in life. How many times does Satan tempt us to say, oh, you know, don't worry about coming back Sunday night. Sunday night doesn't count. Wednesday night doesn't count. I remember hearing my dad tell a story about a man who had a dream. In his dream, he was standing in the judgment day line. There's a big, long line of people. And in this dream, he knew that God was judging everybody. And he said all of a sudden at the back of this line where he was, he heard back up at the front a great shout of joy. And they thought, what's this all about? And somebody came running back to inform the rest of the line. They said, Wednesdays don't count. Wednesdays don't count. Yeah, that's kind of how we do. It's like, well, Wednesdays don't count. Well, does it have? Where does the Bible say I have to be there on Wednesday night? Where does the Bible say I have to be there on Sunday night? Where does the Bible say I have to do this and I have to do that and I have to be here and I have to be there? And you know, it kind of betrays our thinking, doesn't it? And so we're passing little tests or failing them every day of our lives, and we need to look at those things. Oh, it's just a little white lie. Well, if you fail the little white lie test, then you're going to fail the big black lie test when the time comes, aren't you? One man said one time, well, you know, everybody has his price, which means you'll do anything for the right amount of money. And that statement's not true, but you know the man who said it has his price. And he thinks because he has no character, everybody else doesn't either. So we have to be careful that we don't view the rest of the world in light of our self-examination. So you just remember this, young people, old people, and everybody in between. How are you doing with the little test every single day? And if you're failing those tests, then now's the wake-up call. Start doing the right thing all the time, regardless. That's what character does. A lack of character and a lack of maturity says, but it's not fair. I can't help it. Everybody else is doing it. We make excuses. You don't see Daniel or Shadrach or Meshach and Abednego whining and bellyaching and feeling sorry for themselves. Woe is me, the world's against me. You do the right thing all the time regardless. And as 1 Peter chapter 4 says, like Jesus Christ did when he was mistreated, you commit your soul to him who judges righteously. You let God worry about what's fair. You let God even up the score. You just do the right thing, period, and that's your job. And so what are our little tests? Well, all the things we've talked about. Telling a little white lie. Too cowardly to stand up for Jesus at work or at school or among our best friends of the world. Not giving in to peer pressure. Being willing to stick out in the crowd. Well, that's really not a very comfortable thing to do. Well, the enraged king says, all right, I gave you a chance. Now you've really had it. If he was mad before, when they gave him that answer, that just really teed him off. So it says in verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You ever seen that? Somebody wants you to say one thing and you have to say the truth, which is another thing, and all of a sudden they just change them. They never look at you the same again. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats and their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Have you ever been in a fire that hot? Or anywhere near one like that? I remember one time my dad and some friends of his and I were all going bird hunting, and we were going bird hunting in northeast Arkansas, and it was in the middle of the winter, and it was cold. I mean cold, cold. You have to be a true hunter to appreciate why do people get up before the crack of dawn and go hunting in that kind of condition, but we did. And we're all wrapped in our insulated underwear and our shirts and pants and coats. And we're driving down the road, and if you didn't think it was cold, you could stick your finger on the window, and it was almost frosty on the inside. It was that cold. As we're driving down this highway, before dawn, we see this big bright light off in the corner, and as we get closer and closer, we realize a house is on fire, and it's burning. And by the time we get there, it's totally engulfed, and we can see We can see the dining room table and chairs sitting there because all the outside's been burned into it, and it's just being consumed. So we drove down to see if there was anybody that needed help. And before we got within 100 feet of that fire, you could feel the heat coming through the window. And mind you, it was freezing cold outside. When we got out to check, it was so hot you couldn't get too close to that fire. It would just burn you up. And yet that's nothing like this fire that we're reading about here. This fire was so hot that the men carrying Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to throw them in, they died in the fire themselves. And that's kind of sad. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were burned up in a split second, so it didn't matter, right? No. Read the rest of the story. Verse 23, these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound in the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king, look, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now there's four men in there. The angel of the Lord, which some have suggested might be Jesus in his pre-incarnate state. But whoever it is, it's God's messenger to save these men's lives. And under the worst possible circumstances, they're not harmed a bit. Science would tell you that couldn't happen. That's just a fairy tale. It's just one of those great stories you tell. The Bible says it's a factual matter and it's history. They were unharmed. And Nebuchadnezzar was impressed. He went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then they came out from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and king's counselors gathered together, and they saw that these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. They didn't even smell like they'd been near fire, much less being burned by it or singed by it. I remember when I was about 9 years old living in Arkansas in the summer about like this, we'd get out and play, and we'd go down the store and buy firecrackers, and we'd have a good time with firecrackers. Went down to the ball field to see what we could blow up, you know, tin cans and glass bottles that you shouldn't be blowing up. We did. So we're lighting firecrackers, and all of a sudden I smell the worst smell in the world. Something is burning. Stinks. It's awful. Next thing I know, my head's starting to hurt. So I patted it out. Somehow a spark had gotten in my hair and started burning it. And it didn't hurt until it got down the roots. And you've probably singed your eyebrows or your hair before, haven't you? You don't have to be in the fire to singe your hair. Just be close by. Not these men. Not one hair on their head was bothered. That's a miracle, isn't it? A miracle based on faith. And what we learn is, because the courage of these three young men who the Bible goes on to say trusted in God and decided to worship God only and to do the right thing regardless, they changed the history of their nation. They changed the lives of many people who have followed their example since then. And they can change your life today if you'll do what they did by following their example. But now ask yourself, what if these three Jewish men had bowed down to the idol? Because in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 10, Demas followed the Lord and followed the Apostle Paul. When Paul was thrown in a Roman prison, he wrote to Timothy, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. If Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego had done that, we never would have learned the lessons of this morning. Remember, don't do what the multitude does. And again, in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, remember lesson number 2, and that is, you and I are being tested every day, whether we realize it or not. And Peter wrote and said, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. And see, the little test for these Christians in Peter's day were the various trials. But he said, that is for the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by what? Fire. May be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And so the big test is, you'll be found glorious at the judgment day. So, are you prepared for the judgment day? Will your faith stand the big test? And the answer is, the way you know and the way you prepare is you pass the little test every single day. Don't read the newspaper, listen to the radio, talk show host, or any of those things to find out what's right and wrong. Stick your nose in God's Word and learn right and wrong based on what God's Word says. And then once you know the right thing, develop the courage to do the right thing, and then young people and old people alike, always do the right thing regardless. And not only will God bless you for it, but your life will be a blessing to everyone who knows you. And your life will be so much easier. If you'd like to do the right thing this morning by obeying the gospel so that you can begin passing the little test, then we invite you to come. Faith in Jesus as God's Son is a test. Being willing to repent of your sins is a test. Being willing to confess before this audience with your courage, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, is a test. And Jesus said, if you confess me before men, I'll confess you before my Father in heaven. Being baptized in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins is a test. And rising to walk in a new life is a test. And being faithful unto death is a test. And if you pass those tests, the big test is easy. Will you obey the gospel this morning while we stand and sing?